You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Welcome to Afternoon Cyber Tea, where we talk with some of the biggest security influencers in the industry about what is shaping the cyber landscape and what is top of mind for the C-suite and other key security decision makers. I'm Ann Johnson, and today we are talking about historical approaches to cybersecurity design and the signs that it may be time for a change. Today, I'm joined by Genevieve Lively, who is the Professor of Classics, RISCS Fellow and Turing Fellow at the University of Bristol. She is a narratologist whose research interests focus upon narratives and narrative theories, both ancient and modern, and their impact on future thinking. She has particular research interests in the stories that program cultural and socio-technical narratives about human interactions with new technology. Genevieve, welcome to Afternoon Cyber Tea.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So I'm really excited about this topic. On Afternoon Cyber Tea, we have a lot of different speakers that do everything from policy to deep technology. And we had a session a few years ago. We were even talked with a researcher on the Internet of Bodies. So all of those topics are fascinating, and I find every episode fascinating. And this one, again, is just a little bit different from anything we've talked about. So in 2019, you wrote a paper titled Homer's Intelligent Machines, AI in Antiquity. I want to start our conversation here because in cybersecurity, we often talk about how the diversity of data and signals influence AI outcomes and responses to cyber threats. And I would love for you to share how your work tracing this ancient narrative history of AI helps us examine the impact of contemporary debate about the nature of AI and responsible AI.
Cool. Well, thank you. This is what I love to talk about, and I can go on about this all day. This is part of my Turing Fellowship research, and it's incredible, isn't it, that humans have been thinking about AI and telling stories about AI for the past 3,000 years. Every now and then I have a little moment and my mind is temporarily blown while I just sort of get my head around the fact that people have been thinking about artificial machines, intelligent machines, for 3,000 years. It predates the technology of writing these fictions about AI. And the other thing that I find incredible about this work is that the way that AI is represented in ancient Greek myth, that's my particular area of interest, that's my starting point, if you like, for this kind of long-range study. But we find that in ancient Greek myth, that we get the same patterns of thinking about AI that we find in modern representations and thinking as well. The parallels are incredible. Some good, some maybe not so good, and just give us pause for thought, particularly that question that you posed to me for us thinking about responsible AI and contemporary debates about ethics and AI. So these debates are already there in the ancient stories around AI, and some parallels may be troubling. I'm going to run through some examples for you because this is the juicy stuff. As I say, I could tell you the story of AI forever, but there are, you know, golden robotic slave girls in the workshop of Hephaestus, the metalworking god. I imagine they sort of look something like, you know, the sort of the robot creatures from Metropolis. And we also get some really boring, you know, relatively boring sort of AI widgets, kind of so very weak eye, but they're things that open the gates of heaven are controlled by this kind of weak AI issues. There are tripods, these amazing, strange tables, if you like, that move back and forth between houses. We've got automatic bellows. We have industrial AI. And something that I've been working on recently, which you can tell I've been working with the National Centre for Cybersecurity here in the UK, I think I found the first recorded example of some AI-assisted cybercrime. So the god sends his tripods, which are kind of cryptocurrency, out into other people's houses, and then he calls them back again of their own accord. These things can move because they have this AI enhancement, and in a sense he's kind of sending them out and then he's just having them back. It's a very tentative cybercrime example.
It's absolutely fascinating, too, right, because we just think about computers. We don't think about everything that came before that was actually the predecessor of, you know, the modern computer, right?
Exactly. And this is basic. We think of this as, you know, basic technology. But 3,000 years ago, a sophisticated set of hinges on a gate, that's pretty high spec. Having these tripods, that I always think of them as an elaborate hostess trolley, if you know what I'm thinking of here, sort of a little thing on wheels. But that's cutting edge technology 3,000 years ago. And these things really did exist. We can see them in the archaeological record. And sometimes they have little animal feet, sometimes they have wheels. And then they go back to the 12th century BCE. So this technology does exist. And we also know that the ancients sort of experimented with automata. So this isn't, you know, purely speculative science fiction. They're telling stories about these things, and later on that they have them in museums, they have them on their street corners. One of the things that I have spotted, though, that, as I said, one of those parallels between ancient and modern ways that people talk about AI is that in the ancient world, of course, it's a slave-based economy. And when they talk about the AIs, they tend to talk about them in the same way that they talk about their slaves, whether those are household domestic servants or slaves in the field, slaves in industry, and that's all personal assistant slaves. So some of the sort of paradigms that we have now, thinking about what AI can do in the home, in industry, and of course in the criminal context, all those examples are there in the ancient Greek myths, in Homer, in the Homeric epic. So, for example, you could see those golden slave girls, the robotic slave girls, the AI Amphipoloi. The Greek word is Amphipoloi. They come out and they help the god Hephaestus. He's disabled. He needs their help, not just in his workshop, but they help him dress. They help him wash up. And I just can't help but see the way that they're written about 3,000 years ago. I see echoes of Alexa and Siri, as well as all those, you know, sort of hot robotic AI creatures in TV series and movies.
So let me ask you a question about that, because as you're thinking about it, we talk a lot about responsible AI, right? And how we can future-proof and make sure that AI is used for good, you know, however you define good. Yeah. Was that even a concept? As you think back to the Homer days, right? And as you think back to the slave labor, right? And having these assistants that were essentially slaves, was anyone thinking, do you, in your mind, or were there any writings about it being responsible or ethical, or how do you use this labor? What were the boundaries? Are there parallels there?
There are really interesting parallels, but it's really tricky to analyze because of the way that they think about slavery. It's in a really abhorrent way to a modern mind. So we find Plato and Aristotle, you know, we think these great philosophers, they have appalling views on slavery and women, you know, two things that they're really not great on, but they are questioning the notion of slavery, and they're using AI examples in their thinking about whether slavery is okay, what it means to be a slave as opposed to a free citizen. They're also thinking about gender issues, about the difference between the kind of thinking that women can do and the thinking that men can do. I mean, as I say, a lot of this stuff is really abhorrent to the modern mind. But they are, I think, just stumbling towards some of the ethical issues that are of concern to those of us asking ourselves these questions in the 21st century. So Plato has a really interesting section where he's trying to work out the difference between sort of a basic level of thinking where you just believe everything. Everything is a hunch and you just sort of act on instinct. And he's trying to distinguish between that kind of thinking and higher level, philosophical, you know, a higher educated reason and logic. And he thinks that lower order intelligence is the kind of thing that slaves and women and these artificial AI robotic creatures from Homer exhibit. And he talks about, you know, you've got to keep them all chained up or they'll just, you know, they'll run away. You've got to keep them safely under control. And that also raises issues for our concerns about AI and potentially the sort of tech fears that we have, that our technology will turn against us. it's really fascinating.
That is an interesting parallel, right? That if we don't contain, you know, people talk, you know, and it's science fiction now, right? But we think about things becoming sentient, right? And computers actually taking over. And there is a parallel there, right? The slaves, if they had free will, they would just leave and potentially take over.
Exactly. Plato's mostly concerned they'll run away. We don't see that. We don't get fears about rebellion so much until much later in history, which is interesting in itself. So they won't sort of turn against us. That Asimov, Frankenstein complex that comes back later. We actually don't find that precisely in the ancient world. We don't have the idea that the AI or the robots will turn against us, turn against humans, but they will run away. And clearly, I think that's rooted in this a real slave economy where they're used to, if I'm a slave, I'm running. If any chance I get, I'm getting out of there, right? And I think that's the sense that these AI robots will behave like that. They will run away. So in the sense of kind of harnessing intellectual forces, harnessing the best innovations in tech, but the fear that it will leave us if we don't control it really rigidly. I think those are dynamics that we're still trying to run around in our heads today.
So if we bring it to modern times, you had mentioned as you were speaking that you think you found a recent evidence of AI-assisted cyber attack. I did a webinar a few weeks ago on adversarial machine learning and defending, you know, your machine learning models and your data models against cyber criminals. Can you talk a little bit about what you're thinking about the threat potentially is of, you know, adversarial machine learning or AI-assisted cyber attacks, how great you think, and even your thoughts on the time frame, right? What is the time frame that we're going to realistically see wholesale or more in the wild adversarial-assisted cyber attacks?
I don't know. I'm always really, it's such a great question. I'm always hesitant about posing kind of timeframes on developments in any emerging kind of tech space, because people do things that you think should be really obvious very slowly. As I say, 3,000 years of AI, and we haven't really gone much further than the imaginaries of the ancient Greeks. And then other things just come out of nowhere or seem to. They're in development for, you know, a couple of years, and everything just falls into place and it comes through really rapidly. But I think it's fair to say that the developments in machine learning are racing ahead, and this should be something that's feasible within, you know, the kind of the near future. For me, one of the questions, the big questions when we're thinking about this sort of adversarial machine learning and helping us kind of defend against cyber criminals, is an issue that I think comes out of the interest that I have in looking at patterns that repeat in modernity from antiquity. So there's a connection here as well. And that's the issue of bias, this sort of the human sort of heuristic, the human biases, the cognitive frameworks which we bring to bear whenever we do any work on AI. And I think there are a number of different biases or heuristics. In my work, as of different people, when I talk about biases in AI, some people, you can see them hunch their shoulders and that they prefer me to talk about heuristics. And other people just think heuristics is a fancy word for bias, and they are quite right. But hey, I think there are a number of different biases that can shape machine learning in this problem space. And I think there's one that I'm going to pinpoint because I'm an ancient historian, and that's the bias of history. And I think when we're kind of training these machines, when we're developing the algorithms, when we're giving them the data, however much, you know, we put into there, that bias of history is a really big issue. And that translates into this adversarial machine learning, into a kind of lack of novelty in the modeling. So any forecast of future attacks, the forecast of who the next set of bad actors are going to be, these are going to be based on the past, right? They're not, all the data in is going to be historic, so their future predictions are going to be repeating historic patterns. And that's good, but only up to a point. It's never going to tell us the whole picture. And as a narratologist, then that's, for me, it tends to bias the outputs, the scenarios that we produce towards something that I call presentism or chronocentrism. It kind of locks us in the present with an eye to the past. And it's kind of, I sort of put it like this, it limits our ability and our kind of AI assistance. I'm back to that old fashioned Homeric mode for talking about the AI here, but it really limits our opportunity to expect the unexpected. We're always going to be sort of privileging known trends, and also the kind of concerns of the present moment. We're always going to be sort of fighting the last cyber attack, worrying about the threat actors who are in the headlines right now. And I think we need to find ways to help our AI to learn to expect the unexpected. I think if we can find better ways to get them to deal with discontinuities, with reversals and with surprises, I think maybe we need to get them better at stories and storytelling and story processing, because that's full of plot twists and surprises. I think bringing together some sort of story bots with some of these adversarial machine learning could be a very interesting experiment. But I think that's the way, if we're really to identify future threats and not just rehearse the past all the time, we're going to need to find different ways of doing this stuff.
I think that makes sense. And I do think we have like a historical bias, right? We know that history often will repeat itself, but it's not, there are also future threats that we've never seen historically, right? And we need to frame our thinking about threats. And to your point, there's a lot in the headlines right now, but they aren't necessarily the biggest threats that organizations are facing. They're just the noisiest threats or the biggest profile threats. And we need to think about that. I want to pivot really quickly and talk a little bit about social media and deep fakes and disinformation, misinformation, everything that we're dealing with right now that's only, by the way, going to get more prevalent and worse in a way. But how do you think, what is top of mind for you in your research when you think about social media and disinformation and misinformation and deep fakes and all of those things that are happening around us that people are using, right? To create their, as I say, to create their own reality, to create their own narratives.
It's a fascinating area, isn't it? And it really speaks to my research in stories and narratives. Because I think the big thing we do with social media is to tell and share stories. And that could be presenting your perfectly curated life and your perfectly curated kind of lifestyle and character, the one that you want the world to see. It's the cover story that sort of hides the gorgeous chaos of messy reality. So that's a big driver for so much social media. But also, we're using these platforms to try to make people smile, to entertain them, maybe to make them think, maybe to make them buy something. But what we're doing is telling and selling stories. That speaks to a very primitive part of the human brain, which is this storytelling aspect that we all have. And I mean, we're human animals who are hardwired for story. It's how we make sense of the world. It's how we make sense of ourselves. There's a great phrase that gets used, which is homo narrans. We're the storytelling ape. We're not the wise ape. We're not sapiens. We're narrans. We tell stories. That's what distinguishes us from the other monkeys. But social media has given us a whole new forest, a whole new ecosystem for those stories. And we're still working out how to climb the trees and how to live in that space. And I think that the growth of that new digital ecosystem has been so fast that we're just not really equipped to navigate our way through it. And that means it's really hard sometimes. And I say sometimes, a lot of the time, it's really hard to tell the fiction from the facts, to tell those deepfakes apart. They're so good. And it's just really hard to do this. And as a narratologist, it's really hard to judge whether we're dealing with what we would call reliable narrators or biased narrators. Because in a sense, everyone is a biased narrator or an unreliable narrator in this platform, right? And, you know, friends in security, you know, refer to this as disinformation. I call it unreliable narration in my world. It's fake news. It's deep fake. It's fake news. And this stuff is, we love it. We yum it up because we are these storytelling creatures. And as we've seen through the pandemic and recent political situations, this is hugely dangerous. And we get these sort of socially engineered cyber threats and are translating into real world harms. And this, you know, it really needs to kind of focus our attention. And I think about this a lot, and I do think it's not a question anymore of if, but rather a question of how we bring in the legislation and the regulation to help social media companies and other platforms tackle this.
I don't think it's easy, right? They're not traditional publishers. It's kind of the wild, wild west, as we would say here, right? Yeah. Of no regulation. And it's really challenging, because if you get to the point of saying that a social media platform is liable for what is put on their platform, then they're going to have to, you know, content moderation is hard as is, you know, thinking of the millions of transactions they deal with on a daily basis. If you say they're going to be liable for what's posted on their platform, there's going to be very little posted on their platform, right? Because they're going to... Yeah. They're going to view everything. And suddenly that urgency of posting and that, you know, that real time, the human behavioral aspects and the psychological aspects of the real time experience goes away. So it is something we're going to have to think about, though, because it's changing society. We only have a few more minutes. So I'm going to ask you a closing question. But before I do that, I want to make a nod to Alan Turing, because you are, you know, working on behalf of the Turing Institute. And we have started... we're recording this during U.S. Pride Month. And for those of you who don't know who Alan Turing was, who's listening to the podcast, he was a mathematician and a crypto analyst and a philosopher. He was also convicted for being gay at the time when it was outlawed in the UK. And he ended up either accidentally or on purpose dying of cyanide poisoning. Never has been really determined, I don't think, whether it was accidentally or he committed suicide. I think that's still in the... But it was only until, I believe, 2013 that the Queen actually gave him a pardon against his conviction. I mean, we're talking about very recent events. So I wanted to give that nod just because we're you know, recording during U.S. Pride Month, and he was one of the leaders. I mean, had he lived a longer life, it would have been just, he did so much in a short life, and it just would have been amazing to see this brilliant man and this brain, what he could have produced even over a longer period of time. So wanted to give that nod, Genevieve, while
that's
we're here.
Awesome. I'm so glad you did that. That's lovely. Thank you. And again, it just shows us how fast the pace of history changes. You could say 2013 for a posthumous pardon. Dear Lord, this is just, for something, yeah. You know, in relatively recent history, which was just so challenging for so many people. So, yeah, excellent shout out. That's delightful.
So what is your biggest takeaway from your research when you think about cyber defense, but particularly about human behavior and how it relates to cyber defense?
I think I'm going to kind of pick up on one of the points that I made earlier, but I think the issue for me at stake here is almost a lack of imagination about the future, potentially restricting what we are able to do, really limiting the art of the possible here. Human actors are fantastic. So many stories about real world cyber attacks in the past few years show us that it's the human actors who really come to the fore. There's a positive, if I can put it like this, sometimes a really positive outcome for some cyber attacks because humans come together, they show resilience, they build resilience, they really find new ways of doing new things better. And I think that's something that we could celebrate more and bring into our thinking about cybersecurity as we imagine new ways of doing it more effectively, doing it differently.
We talk a lot about the human spirit, and I absolutely love that answer that you can just never underestimate the power of the human spirit. So we always try to leave our audience with a couple practical things. Do you have just a couple of pieces of guidance for our audience about how they should be thinking about artificial intelligence, the future, how they protect themselves, right, their families, et cetera, or even their work environments? Just a couple of thoughts that, you know, even if it's not advice, maybe it's something you want to make sure people think about.
That's a really great question. And I suppose for me, that kind of keys into questions about that ecosystem, that whole ecosystem around cybersecurity and AI and digital security. I mean, and I'm a big fan of your work on digital empathy. I really think that is the, if, if if there's a key to the future of better cybersecurity and digital lives, it's got to be empathy. And I think that could go a long way in so many avenues in the work that we all do, and in our personal lives with social media and the devices that we use, including the really old-fashioned ones that need, you know, lots of updates, that aren't really secure, that are hanging around, and just keeping ourselves and our families, that the hand-me-down devices that you give to grandma, just thinking about that empathy, understanding how diverse this ecosystem is, how many different people are living here, and everyone's got very different needs, wants, and desires, and no one size fits all. So no one take home fits all, she says, having emphasized the one take home should be empathy. So I'm sorry for contradicting myself in the final stage of the conversation.
No, that's these are dynamic conversations. That's why I love doing a podcast, right? We have a couple questions we kind of script, but other than that, it's free form and we see where the conversation goes. So thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it. I know you have large time commitments. So thank you for joining me today. And thank you to the audience for listening. We look forward to having you join us next time on Afternoon Cyber Tea. So as we think through guests for Afternoon Cyber Tea, we always want us to bring something new and different to our audience, unique perspectives, different ways of thinking. As you know, cyber attacks are only on the increase, and we don't want to always have the same ways of, you know, bringing critical thinking to cyber attacks. So Genevieve Lively was just a really interesting guest to me because she has this research that she does as an erotologist of like ancient Greece, right? And the work of Homer and Plato and how those things even relate to AI or parallels to the world we're in now. And I think we can learn a lot from her by understanding how we're repeating some of the same patterns, but also understanding we need new thinking. And finally, we talk a lot about the human spirit. Genevieve really works with the human spirit and how human beings can overcome anything. We just need to be resilient and we need to be creative and we need to be in the moment.
This week on the Microsoft Threat Intelligence Podcast, we're talking scumbots with Paul Melson. Believe me, you're going to want to hear this. Be sure to listen in and follow us at msthreatintelpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.